So week five here, we are continuing our way through. So if you remember, if you're here last week, we're in 104 down the hall there. We finished off the book of Judges and got kind of into a whole five verses of Ruth. So not too far into Ruth, but a little bit there. And so kind of the plan for tonight is to finish the book of Ruth and then just kind of get through the introduction to 1 Samuel. So that's kind of our goal. So a little more narrowed down, not going quite as crazy here, going through all this. And my notes decided to update right now, so that's great. Gotta like having an app update. But anyway, so as that's updating, we'll just review for a moment here, just again, get us caught up to speed as we kind of get into Ruth, just where we've been. So just a brief review of what we've covered in the Old Testament survey so far. Just Joshua in general, of what we saw was God bringing the nation of Israel into the promised land, establishing them there as a nation. And really, they were established as a nation for a purpose. Okay, they were established there for a purpose in which they were supposed to make an international impact, right? If you remember, like all the way even back in Exodus, that they were supposed to be a light to the nations, right? They were supposed to be kingdom priests. They were supposed to have this international impact. And really, they were supposed to put God's agenda on display, okay, to the nations around them. And that, what's that agenda? It's that God has created everything, that he really does own everything. And so everything is supposed to point back to him and his glory. And so even though that's the plan, what we started seeing in Joshua was that Israel was sinful. Okay, that's an issue. And therefore, they couldn't really live up to the plan. So they have some fractures forming in Joshua. And those failures would eventually plunge them into crisis, which is what we saw in the book of Judges. Okay, and so Judges showed us that due to Israel's failure on both kind of the physical and spiritual level, they failed to conquer the land. They were not faithful to do that, as well as they were turning to false gods. Because of those failures, they entered into a crisis. Okay, and when the first crisis we saw was the crisis of leadership. And that was the majority of the book of Judges. That was all seen in the judges themselves, that they were not good and godly individuals, right? They got a little more corrupt as the book of Judges went on. And so they failed to lead Israel in godliness and righteousness. They were not that example in that way. And really that crisis in leadership was to point us to and show us that you need a what? King, right? Yeah, you need a king. And so you need the true leader who can lead in godliness and righteousness. That's part of that. But then we also saw, especially last week when we wrapped up Judges, is that the problem is not just with the leadership, but it was also with the people themselves, right? There's a crisis within themselves, that the people themselves were messed up. They were wicked. They were sinful. We saw that on full display those last handful of chapters in Judges, where you just saw kind of violation after violation of God's commands and laws, where it's like they just keep digging themselves deeper with all their sin. And all that, again, was to point to the fact that you need a what? You need a king, right? That's what the emphasis of the text always kept coming back to. That's how Judges even wrapped up at the very end there, right? Ends with that phrase of, in those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes, okay? So it's all linked to a king. But we also saw with that wickedness on display of part of what would make a true king is someone who could also reform the nation. Okay, so you need more than just a good political leader or a good military leader. You need someone who could actually work in the hearts of the people and reform the nation. Okay, that's what you really need. But despite all that wickedness, God was faithful to preserve his nation, which again was allowing for a king to come. And so his plan is continuing to move forward, and that's where we got into the book of Ruth, okay? And again, as we went through the book of Judges, that's a very dark period in Israel's time, and it's easy to just think and assume that everything was just so bad during that time, that all of Israel is bad, nothing good going on during that time. But what the book of Ruth shows us is that this is the bright spot in the midst of all the darkness, right? In the midst of all the sinfulness, the wickedness, there are still people who are faithful in following the Lord, okay? And that's where we had our theme for Ruth, was that the God who preserves a remnant, that he preserves a faithful people even in the darkest times. So God is going to do that. And what you also see in Ruth is that, again, God's plan is still on track, okay? His plan is on track, even in the midst of all the terrible things that are going on in the time of the judges, all that. God's plan is moving forward, and specifically, that plan is moving forward to get a king and getting the right king, right? The true king, and that's where Ruth is going to take us, okay? All right, so then Ruth, and then last week, again, we got into these first five verses, so just to kind of catch us up to speed here, we saw kind of this prologue, this introduction, setting the scene to what's going on in the book of Ruth, and really, we just saw this overall arching theme of, like, disaster strikes. All right, disaster strikes. And really, we confirmed, right? Verse 1, it says, like, in the days when the judges ruled. So, again, this is all taking place in the time of the judges, okay? So this is what we're talking about. This is the bright spot in the midst of the dark backdrop of judges. So it takes place in our time, and it's a time when Israel is under curse from God. And we know that because there's famine in the land. And that was one of the curses of Deuteronomy 28. If they were not faithful to follow the law, God said, hey, like, I will bring curses on the land. And one of those was famine. And so we see that happening. And we're introduced to an Israelite by the name of Elimelech, or Elimelech, however you want to pronounce that. And he takes his wife Naomi and his two sons. They go to the land of Moab. And then what happens to, what kind of starts happening? Yeah, everyone just kind of starts dying, right? Like, Elimelech dies. His two sons then marry Moabite women, which wasn't great. That's not a good thing. And then the two sons die. And so now you're kind of left in this situation where Naomi's there in this foreign land, and she has her two daughters-in-laws, but no husband, no sons, and really in a rough situation. Okay, and so she has her two daughters-in-law, Orpah and Ruth, and that's where we kind of left off last week, right, setting that stage. And so what is going to happen now that all this disaster has struck in this family? And let's see, okay? So kind of this next part, like, Ruth kind of divided into these four acts primarily. So you have, like, a prologue, four acts, and then an epilogue is kind of the structure we're going with here. So this first act we see is the returning to Israel. So returning to Israel, we see that in the remaining part of chapter 1, verses 6 through 22. And really what you see in these verses, in this section, is there's a lot of darkness still at work here, right? Like, there's still not a great situation forming, but even in the midst of that darkness, there's still the bright spot. And in this case, it's kind of Ruth's loving kindness, her character, right, is the bright spot that's on display even in chapter 1. And we see that all throughout as well, but specifically here. And especially her loving kindness is seen in her loyalty as well as her determination. That's what we see in chapter 1. And as we think of this section, so this is, again, like, Naomi's going to head back, but we sometimes view this maybe in a more positive light than it maybe is, and primarily in regards to the relationship between Naomi and Ruth, okay, and her daughter, or even her two daughters-in-laws, not just with Ruth. But I think we normally have them having this good relationship, and the interactions in this chapter are kind of all positive, which may be true. But if you think of the overall context of what's going on in this section, it may not maybe be as positive as we're thinking, right? And so specifically, if you remember, like, when Naomi and them, they get back to Bethlehem, they get back to the land of Israel, do you remember what Naomi tells the people to call her? Remember? What name? Not Naomi. Huh? Yeah, Mara. Yeah, Mara. And do you remember, like, what Mara means? By chance? Yeah, it's, like, bitter, right? It's to be bitter. And it's because she says, like, because God has dealt bitterly with me. And really, she is bitter. Okay, she is bitter. And that's kind of this flavor that you're going to see throughout this. That is, Naomi is bitter, right? She's had all this, these terrible things happen, and she is bitter, really, with God about all this, and we're going to see that kind of unfold. And so if you have that understanding, that context, if that's how she is as she gets back, that kind of might influence some of these interactions a little bit, okay? But with that in mind, let's kind of look at this. So in verses 6 and 7, as we start here, notice kind of the main person doing the action here. What's it like? Is it, because you have all the three people on the scene, right? Naomi, Orpah, Ruth, all of them together. And so you would expect, if all three of them are kind of doing actions, what would you expect? There's a repetition of they did this, they did that. But what do you see in verses 6 through 7? What's the emphasis there? Yeah, it's like singular. It's like she did this, right? All referring to Naomi. Like she arose with her daughters. They're just kind of like tagging along almost in a sense. And she had heard, and so she does this, right? There's this emphasis all on Naomi, where it almost has this feel, this flavor, that she's just kind of doing things and the daughters-in-laws are just kind of like a side note and just kind of, tagging along, almost following her along. And you almost have this thought of like, she almost doesn't seem to want them there necessarily, right? And that seems to be then confirmed the next part here, where she actually tells them to leave her and go home, okay? She tells them to leave and go home. And again, it's possible that this is just intended to be nice and sincere, like go back home and all that. But it's kind of interesting, right? Because the wording that she uses is very interesting. So if you look at verse 8 there, where does she tell them to return? Yeah, your mother's house. So a couple things there. What would that be like almost implying there when she says that? Like, go return to your mother's house. Yeah, Moab, huh? Yeah, kind of. And what's she indicating about their relationship? Yeah, I'm not your mother, right? Go to your mother's house, right? I'm not your mom. Like, go to your mother's house, go back, okay? And that's unique because normally in that, especially that culture, you would expect, and a lot of like commentaries bring up, that you'd expect her to say, go back to your father's house, right? Go back to his house, right? That kind of patriarchal society and all that. And so go back to like that. But it seems like the reason she emphasizes the mother's part of it is to make that kind of connection of, I'm not your mom. Like, why are you following me around? I'm not your mother. Go back to your mother, right? So you can kind of see that, again, that bitterness, right? So I'm not your mother, so leave, okay? And then also another interesting wording here. In verse 9, notice what she tells them, right? And again, even in this, like, there's kind of couched in a lot of good speech. And you could say that's where I think we get the positive side, which it could be positive. But some people might say she's being maybe slightly sarcastic and just saying things in a polite way, but really not. But if you look at like verse, 9, notice it says that, may the Lord grant you to find rest, each of you in the house of your husband. Okay, each in the house of her husband. And what's the problem with that statement? Their husbands are what? Dead, right? So you're like, how do you find rest in the house of your husband? And so that can be taken in two ways, right? One kind of positive of maybe she's telling them to like, hey, go remarry and like find rest in your new husband's house kind of a thing and all that. Or you could take it as how do you find rest in the house of your husband? If your husband is dead, then how do you find rest in your dead husband's house? You need a what? Yeah, you need to die, right? Like, essentially, right? And so some people speculate, like, she would be saying, like, hey, like, go die, right? Essentially. Nicely, right? Like, may God let you go die, right? Like, and so, and you just see, like, she is bitter, right? She is bitter, and she is angry with all this, like, of what is unfolded. And so, again, there could be the positive, but there also could be a lot of bitterness involved here, okay? But again, we see a bright spot in all this, and that's where Ruth's kind of interaction, right? Because as these interactions unfold, the other daughter-in-law, Orpah, she ends up leaving. She goes back home, all that, which makes sense, right? If someone's telling you, like, I'm not your mom, go die. I might not want to stick around with her either, right? That's not probably a good thing. But Ruth remains, right? Ruth remains. And in verse 16 especially, she says something so profound, right? Because what? She's like, I'm not going to leave you. I'm going to go where you go. I'm going to follow you. But then even more significantly, at the end of verse 16, she says what? She says, your people shall be my people and your God, my God. And so what is Ruth basically saying? I am converting, right? I'm converting. I will no longer be a Moabitess. I want to become an Israelite. I want to follow your God. I don't want to follow the gods of the Moabites anymore. I want to be part of your people. I want to follow your God. And we see even in that next verse, verse 17 says, where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. May the Lord do so to me, and more also, if anything but death parts me from you. And so notice in that verse and kind of her support of like, may the Lord do so to me, right? Like, she uses that personal name of God. She uses Yahweh, okay? She doesn't use the general name God of may God do this to me. She uses the covenant Israelite name Yahweh in this kind of confirmation here. And so she is really showing that she is accepting the very God of Israel. Okay, she's accepting the very God of Israel. And this is conversion, right? This is a reassigning of loyalty. Okay, that's what's going on here. And so she doesn't just say, I want to follow your God. Now she's kind of acting on it, where she's completely turning her back on the gods of the Moabites and saying, they're not my gods. I'm focusing on this God, Yahweh. And so she is turning to the Lord here. So very profound stuff happening here, right? And again, you see that element of who Ruth is and her character there and all that. So that convinces Naomi here. And so that even says, like, when Naomi saw that she was determined to go with her, she said no more, right? Again, you don't really have Naomi responding to this as like, oh, this is so awesome. You're now going to be an Israelite. All this, it's kind of like, well, I guess I'm stuck with you. Let's go, right? Let's go on. And then we see all this supported, right? So they come back to Bethlehem. And this is the part, right, where Naomi comes and the town's kind of stirred up. Oh, Naomi's back, all that. And she says, call me Mara because I'm bitter and God's dealt bitterly with me, all that. But then again, to catch all that we've kind of said here and maybe support this kind of bitter view here, what does she tell the people in verse 21? I went away full and the Lord has brought me back what? Empty. But was she actually empty? Who'd she have? Ruth, right? But in her mind, it doesn't matter, right? Like, Ruth doesn't kind of count in that equation there. So I am empty, and like, Ruth is not part of that, right? So again, you see that element of this, right? Like, she is bitter. And so right now, like, their relationship isn't great. It gets better, right? Like, their relationship does get better. Naomi and Ruth get close. And so if you're like, oh, I always thought it was good, it's like, it gets good, right? It gets good. Just maybe doesn't start out. It's a little rocky in chapter one here. And you just see, again, there's this dark kind of backdrop still hanging here. Okay? But as we turn into chapter two, we start to see kind of this act two, the gleaning in the fields, all that. But what you start to see in chapter two, and it's going to kind of continue on through the rest of the book, is that this element of God changing evil to good. Okay? God changing evil to good. And so even this relationship with Naomi and Ruth, like, it starts maybe rough, kind of on the rocks here, but it gets better. God works it out for good, but he works all this for good. And this theme shouldn't surprise us because, again, if you're around for our survey, Old Testament Survey 1, where we went through the Torah, and especially in the book of Genesis, we saw, like, there are certain foundational truths that were established in, like, the lives of the patriarchs in Genesis. And one of those foundational truths that'd be applicable for like the nation of Israel moving forward was this reality that God turns evil to good, right? If you remember in the story of Joseph with his brothers, all he says that, right? Like, you meant it for evil, but what? God meant it for good. And we see that's something God does throughout all of the Old Testament. All of scripture is him turning evil to good, right? Even Genesis 3:15, right? The fall was saying all that, like, that was evil, but God's going to turn that for good, right? Like, That's what he's always doing, and that's what we see here. So that shouldn't surprise us in all of this. All right. So then chapter 2 begins with a reference to a relative of Naomi's husband, Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And this is, again, kind of setting the stage, foreshadowing of what's kind of to come here. But we see that it is the harvest is starting, which confirms what Naomi had heard in the land of Moab, like, oh, there's food again, all that. The curse of the famine had been lifted, and so there will be food for the people. But even though that's the case, what's the issue for Ruth and Naomi, though?
Poor.
Yeah, they're poor. They don't have the fields, right? They don't have the food. And so there's this ironic situation of where even though, yeah, the famine's lifted and everyone's getting all fed and full and all that, they could still die of starvation, right? Because they don't have the fields. They don't have the support. They don't have all that. But we see Ruth here take the initiative. She goes to the fields to glean among the ears of grain that were left by the harvesters, and so she can get some food for herself and Naomi, right? She's taking these initiatives. And this is all kind of lining up with like the Mosaic law that talks about, like in Leviticus 19, that the people of Israel were not supposed to, like as they're like doing their harvest, they weren't supposed to harvest all the way to the edges of their crops. And then even as they're harvesting, if they drop some, they're not supposed to go back and like collect it. They just leave it. And the question is why? Because this was one of the ways they were supposed to show compassion to the poor and the needy of the nation, right? As a way to support them. And so these gleanings were left for them so that they would have food. And so the field that she ends up at has people who are being faithful to this command. They're doing this. They're letting people glean as they go, okay? They're not just as they're dropping stuff like, hey, you don't get that, right? Like, that's mine. They're letting the people glean just as God had commanded. And in verse 3, we get to find out whose field she ends up going to, and whose field does she end up at? Boaz's, right? Yeah. Surprise, right? So, yeah, Boaz's. And who we saw mentioned earlier is part of the clan of Elimelech. And notice how the text describes this, right? It says, like, she happened to come, okay? Like, she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz. And what we have to understand here, right, is, like, when you read that on the surface, this sounds like this was by chance, right? Like, oh, she just happened to kind of stumble upon. But was this really by chance? No, right? This is all part of God's plan. Like, and really, like, if you don't have her end up in the right place at the right time, like, the genealogy of the Messiah gets broken, right, as we see later. So that's bad, like all this. So it isn't by chance. But what, like, the Hebrew language does sometimes is it uses, like, the language of chance or luck or things like that to essentially focus in and point you on, like, there really are no chances. Right, there are no chances. That it's kind of does this to negate that thought that this is all by luck or chance. Okay, and so from a human perspective, events like this might seem to be by chance. Like Ruth wasn't, like, I don't think, trying to walk to a different field and like, I just can't walk that way, I have to walk this way, right? Like, she didn't know, right? She's going where, like, oh, just this field looks good, right? But we know that in reality it was God working. It was God directing her to the right field at the right place at the right time. It was all God working here, okay? And so as she is gleaning, we see Boaz finally kind of comes on the scene here, and he notices Ruth. And what does he ask about her? You guys catch that? What does he ask? He asks his young man about her. How does he frame that question? Yeah, whose young woman is this? He doesn't like ask like specifically like, who is that, right? But it's almost like, who does that woman belong to in a sense? And again, there's a couple ways you could take this. Maybe that was kind of the way they primarily asked. But it seems to be when he asked this way that he's trying to kind of probe and find out a little bit more information, right? Find out a little bit more information here. Primarily, probably about her marital status. Okay, of like, oh, does she have a husband? Or maybe even he could have been asking who her parents are, kind of a thing. And it's, well, why would he want to know who her parents were? Some argue it's because, what, in that culture at that time, how would you start the process of marriage? You would go to who? The the parent, right? And so it could have been he's wanting to kind of go ask her parents for marriage, right? And so almost like true love at first sight, okay? It was Boaz like, ooh, yeah, I want to marry her, right? Like, she looks awesome. But don't miss how the young man responds to Boaz. What does he emphasize in his response? That she is a what? Moabite. Okay, right? He kind of repeats it. He says, she is a young Moabite woman who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab. Okay, like, and we have to remember, like we talked about in the introduction, and even back in Genesis, the stigma that was part of the Moabite people, right? That was rooted in how they started as a nation with Lot and his daughters and that whole messed up situation. And so they had that stigma that Israel really did look down upon the Moabites. And so she would always be like kind of considered this Moabite. And so that's what's at play here, that he's essentially like Boaz. She's a Moabite, like Moabite, right? Like you can't do this kind of a thing. But that does not faze Boaz. And instead, he shows Ruth so much compassion, right? And he even goes to her and encourages her to not glean in any other field, but instead kind of stick close to his other young women that are gathering and all that for the rest of the harvest, right? He shows compassion on her. He doesn't just say, oh, Moabite? Ugh, like, okay, like, never mind, right? No, he shows compassion here. And in response to this compassion, look at verse 10. How does she respond to him? What does she do? What action does she do?
Fell on her face.
Yeah, and it says, fell on her face, bowing to the ground, right? And normally, like in the Old Testament, this language is normally used in the actions that you do before a king, right? Of someone falling on their face, bowing before them, right? It's someone, almost that language of bowing before a king. And so in a sense, Ruth is proclaiming that Boaz is a king, right? And it's like, well, why? Because he acted with such justice and righteousness, right? He shows compassion on those in need. And you start to see kind of this further bridge from the time of the judges to where we're heading to like the monarchy and eventually with David and culminating Christ, all this stuff, right? And so we talked about this in Judges. One of the ways that the judges themselves had failed to be like the true leaders of Israel is because what? They were not godly and righteous people. They failed in that pursuing of justice and righteousness. And what we saw was a true king would reign in justice and righteousness. And this theme is unfolding further, even in the example of Boaz. Okay, this is what Ruth, as it's moving us towards kind of the right king, the true king, all that, you start getting glimpses of this is what like a true king is going to do. He's going to have compassion. He's going to show justice and righteousness. And we start to see that kind of unfold here in the book of Ruth. Okay. And then we see Boaz kind of explaining why he's showing this compassion, because Ruth has shown care for like Naomi, all that. But then notice especially verse 12 that he also mentions what? That like she has, it says like referring to Yahweh, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge, right? He understands that she has sought refuge under like the God of Israel, under Yahweh. And so that's what we saw Ruth declare in chapter 1, like my allegiance has changed. I no longer want to be the Moabite following these Moabite gods, but I want to follow Yahweh. And he recognizes that. He understands that. And so that's why, like, I don't know, you could think, because Israel wasn't supposed to marry like people of the foreign nations, all that. And you could think, well, why isn't Boaz concerned about that? Because really, like, she's acting like an Israelite. She is an Israelite. She has reassigned her loyalties, no longer be part of the Moabite people. I want to be part of the people of Israel. And so that's what's going on, right? And he recognizes that. All right. And then the rest of the chapter kind of wraps up with Ruth returning home, kind of telling Naomi all that happened in the day and all that. And she's just probably going through all the details. And as she's going through it, there's a certain part that kind of perks Naomi up, right? Remember, she's bitter, kind of all that. But the piece of information that like kind of brightens her up a little bit is when she finally mentions whose field she ended up at. That, I ended up at this guy Boaz, right? Like, Ruth didn't know, right? She wasn't scouting it out. She wouldn't have known this. And so she, this guy Boaz, and that perks her attention, because what does Naomi make the connection? Oh, he's a close relative of us. And especially it says, and one of our redeemers. Okay, and this ties into what we talked about in the intro. There's these couple laws, which are still on the board, so that's nice, that we saw that are going to come into play here in the book of Ruth, the property redemption laws and the levirate marriage laws, but especially the property redemption. It talks about this idea of a redeemer, right, who could redeem like the property of a close relative or stuff like that. And so we start to see that unfold. And so Naomi, when she hears this, right, you can kind of see the wheel spinning in her mind of like, ooh, this is interesting, right? Like, this guy, like, can help us out, right? Like, and this can be something good here. And so she encourages Ruth to continue to glean from Boaz's field, and to, again, stick with his young women for her own safety, she even says, right? Which, again, as we went through the book of Judges, you'd understand that statement, that a lot of terrible things have happened. So, yeah, like, let's stick with some people, be safe, all that. And so that's what she did until the end of the harvest, okay? And then that takes us into chapter 3, okay? Chapter 3, where it kind of now zooms forward a little bit to the end of the harvest. So kind of many weeks have passed since this interaction in chapter 2 to now they're at the end of the harvest. And we see at the beginning of chapter 3 that Naomi really does have concern for Ruth. And so like I said before, like the relationship wasn't maybe great at the beginning, but it's gone better, right? She has concern. She wants to make sure that Ruth is taken care of. And so then she starts developing this plan. And apparently, like, Boaz hasn't really made any further moves towards Ruth in any way. And so Naomi's like, all right, well, I'll kind of take this in my own hands and kind of concoct a plan here to kind of move things forward a little bit, right? Boaz, you're dragging your feet. Let's get this moving. And so this is the whole situation of, again, just kind of one of the elements of scripture, prescriptive or descriptive, not prescriptive, right? This isn't the like, hey, if you want to give counsel to your daughter of how to get a guy to propose to you, this is what you do, right? That's not what's going on here. It's just descriptive, not prescriptive for all the future, right? But she instructs Ruth to kind of wash up, anoint herself, put on her cloak, go down to the threshing floor where Boaz will be sleeping. And while he's sleeping, uncover his feet, then lie down his feet and wait for him to tell you what to do, right? And some people try to like look at this and maybe suggest that there's some sort of sexual connotations or weird stuff with that. But really, that's not here, right? That's not what's happening. That's not the case. And so what you have to understand about this plan is that it is risky, but not risque, right? Like there's that element. It's risky, but not risque, right? There's nothing fishy going on in a sense, but it is a risky kind of plan. And you could say, well, why would this be risky, right? So let's kind of unpack her plan. So Naomi is having Ruth get all dressed up, essentially. She's washing, she's anointing, which might be like putting on like some sort of perfume or something. And then it mentions putting on her cloak. And what this is possibly referring to is to Ruth changing from her garment of widowhood to a normal garment, okay? That would indicate that she is kind of returning to normal life and her like period of mourning her dead husband is now over. And she would then be available for what? Marriage, right? Like she's, yeah, kind of single again and ready to mingle or something, I don't know. Yeah. So again, and that could also explain why Boaz hasn't really done anything at this moment, right? Because he would have been maybe respecting that of like, oh, she's still like in her garment of widowhood. Like I'm not going to make any moves forward with that while she's still mourning, right? And so he wants to be sensitive to that. And so that could explain that as well. And so essentially then what is Naomi's plan? What is she essentially instructing Ruth to do? To like propose, right? Like she's instructing Ruth to kind of propose to Boaz. And so that in and of itself is risky, right? But even beyond just the normal risk of proposing to someone right here, this whole plan of coming to Boaz at night everything could be viewed kind of negatively, potentially by Boaz, potentially by if someone saw that, they could misunderstand what's going on. And so there's a lot of risk here. That's where this is risky, right? Again, it's not risque. It's not like scandalous or anything like that, but it's risky because what? Boaz could wake up and, what are you doing? No, like, I don't want to marry you. Get out, right? Like, leave me alone kind of thing. That's bad. And then all the shame and different things that could be associated, all that stuff, right? So it's really risky. But Ruth obeys. She does all that Naomi had instructed her. And then you know the story. Boaz awakens, finds Ruth there lying at his feet. She essentially proposes to him, like, in asking him to, like, be our redeemer, right? Like, be the redeemer here. And Boaz responds positively. But there's one complication. Do you remember what that complication is? There's what? Yeah, there's a closer relative. There's a closer redeemer. Okay, and so before he can redeem Ruth and, like, the family of Elimelech, they have to give the opportunity to the near relative. But Boaz is determined to resolve this quickly, which he does the very next day, right? Doesn't take much time. Goes the next day, and that's chapter 4, okay, is the redemption at the gate. And we'll finish this up, and then we'll take a little break. So, but chapter 4, redemption at the gate. This picks up very next day. Boaz goes to the city gate. That's kind of the area inside, like, the city gate. Just inside there, that's where they would normally do, like, a lot of their business or even kind of courtroom type stuff would take place there. And so Boaz goes there, gets the relative, and then he gathers some of the elders of the city and kind of makes his case in all of this. And this is where kind of the two laws we talked about are going to come into play here, okay? So he informs the relative, Naomi's selling the land that belonged to Elimelech, their relative, and he encourages him to buy it in order to redeem the property according to the property redemption laws, okay? So that the land would stay within the family, like the clan, the family, right? That was part of what these laws talked about. And so, and Boaz also informs him, like, if you don't want to redeem the property, I will, right? Like, I'm willing, I'm ready. Like, if you don't want me to do it, let me know. I'll do it. But how does the man respond? He says what? Yeah, I'll do it. I'll redeem the property, right? I'll do it. And immediately your heart kind of sinks, right? You're like, oh, what? Like, this seemed like it was going all so well, and now it's getting, like, derailed, and potentially Boaz or other, I don't know if Ruth's there or not watching all this. She's like, oh, no, what's happening? I don't want that guy, or I don't know. So he's like, okay, I'll buy it. But then this is where kind of this, we talked about, like, Boaz's kind of complex legal maneuver, right? Where he kind of combines these two laws of the property redemption, which was, again, about, like, the nearest redeemer redeeming land, so the land stays in the family. He combines this with the levirate marriage laws, which that was kind of in regards to primarily just within the immediate family of, like, brothers, where if a brother who is married dies before he has kids, that one of the other brothers would marry his widow, have a kid that would be in the name of his brother who had died, so that name continues on, so the family doesn't die out, right? So you can kind of see that there's connections, right? There's kind of a connection between the two there. But he kind of combines them into, like, kind of one deal, right? And he explains to this guy that, okay, yeah, if, like, awesome, you're redeeming the property, but also what kind of comes with it is Ruth, okay? That you will have to kind of redeem her as well in order, as he says, to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance. Okay, that's what says in verse 5, right? So in order to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance. And so again, this is when we talk about, like, the levirate marriage. This is a big deal because that was, like, the significant part of this, because in preserving your family member's line and in doing this, you would be essentially surrendering your own name, your own status for the sake of your family member. And so this is why Boaz makes that mention of this is to perpetuate the name of the dead in inheritance, right? And so he's essentially combining these two things to show the guy, like, hey, but if you're doing this, this is not all now, like, your property necessarily, it's all still keeping the family of like Elimelech going, right? This is all like in his name. And like when, if you have a son, like it'll be his property, right? Like all these things, right? All in that name. And so you can understand that's a big deal, right? Especially in that culture at that time. Even today, that'd be a big deal, right? And so that's a big deal. And so the Redeemer, when he hears all that, it's like, well, I don't want to do that. I just want the property, right? I just want the property. And so he says, I'm not going to do it. And so then he encourages Boaz to take his right of redemption instead. Okay, he's like, you want to do it, you can do it. And they have that transaction and taking off the sandal, all that stuff, right? So then Boaz takes it all upon himself to do this. And so you, again, you can't miss the significance, the profound nature of what he's doing here, that he is such this godly man and he cares so much for Ruth that he's willing to potentially like give up his own name and status, all of this to keep Naomi's family going, right? To keep the family of Elimelech going. That's what he's doing here. And so he's willing to sacrifice everything to really get Ruth's family back on track. That's what he's doing, okay? He's going to perpetuate the name of Elimelech, right? Like he's of the dead, right? That's what he's doing here. And so it's such a profound and significant action that Boaz is doing, okay? He's willing to give all that up. And so you can see like, yeah, it's such a great love story, right? Like it's all good. But in the process, it's kind of an interesting thing. Like even though he's willing to give up everything and do this action, what ends up happening with Boaz? He actually kind of gains everything in a sense, right? Because as we see, we'll see this kind of end up. How does he gain everything? He ends up being part of the promised line of the seed, right? Of Genesis 3:15. He becomes part of the line of the Messiah, right? Like that is awesome, right? And we'll see that confirmed in just a moment, but let's kind of finish out this section. So he marries Ruth and the Lord gives her conception and she bears a son named Obed. But notice also you have another interaction between Naomi and the women of the town, right? We had one in chapter 1 when she first kind of got there, and now we're wrapping up with that too. And look at how they describe Ruth's relationship with her. They say what? Like, for your daughter-in-law who loves you, who is more to you than 7 sons, has given birth to a son. And so remember Naomi's first interaction when she said what? Like, I came back empty, right? Including, oh yeah, Ruth's here, but I'm empty, right? Like, kind of a side note. And what are they saying now? Like, she's worth even more than 7 sons, right? And I'm sure Naomi would agree with that statement as well, right? That's probably how she viewed it as well. And that's, again, God has turned evil to good, right? Like, he has turned it for good. And then verse 17 ends this kind of last act here just with an important detail, right? It mentions the birth of Obed, but then we find out what? Obed is the father of Jesse, and Jesse is the father of who? David, right? King David. And so what does that make Ruth and Boaz in comparison to David? They're his what? The great-grandparents, right? Great-grandparents. And so we see, again, God's plan moving forward. That's going to set the stage here for 1 Samuel. And that ties into this very last section here, the epilogue here. And we have a genealogy to kind of close out Ruth here, the genealogy of Perez. And we just have like, these are the generations of Perez. And so it's Perez fathered Hezron all the way down to like David, right? And the question is kind of, well, why bring up this genealogy, right? Why do this genealogy? You just said, like, you just made the connection, like, okay, we get it. Like, David's coming through this line. That's awesome. But why bring up this genealogy right at the end here? Well, look at the terminology. It says, now these are the generations of. Does that ring any bells? Of where else do we see that terminology often? Of these are the generations of so-and-so. It does eventually in the Gospels, but what we've seen before in our Old Testament Survey 1. Yeah, Genesis, right? If you remember, the whole structure of Genesis was structured around these, what we call like the Toledot statements. That's the Hebrew word for genealogy, where it'd say these are the generations of like Abraham, these are the generations of Isaac, right? Like all these things, and it was structured in that way. And the writer here of Ruth picks that terminology up to essentially say, what? Like, I'm picking up where Genesis left off. right? Part of Genesis was moving us forward of who's going to be the seed of Genesis 3:15, who's the Messiah, whose line is this going to be through? Like, oh, it's okay, it's through the line of Abraham, then his son Isaac, then it's through Jacob, right? And then we found out Genesis left off with Judah was kind of the last thing we saw. Oh, okay, be through the line of Judah. But then now you have what? The writer here picking it up of, okay, well, whose son of Judah is it through? It's through Perez, right? And then it's through Hezron and all these all the way down to David, right? And so he is showing that this is the line, okay? And then as was mentioned, this is, again, later on picked up in the Gospel of Matthew. That's why Matthew starts with a genealogy, because he's essentially saying what? I'm finishing what Genesis and Ruth started, okay? There is the line that was coming, and this is the guy that all of this was leading to. It's Jesus, right? He is the Messiah. He is the Christ. And so that's what's going on here. God's plan is continuing to move forward. We are heading toward a king, which Judges showed we so desperately needed. But we also are headed to the true king, right? The king of Genesis 49:10, the king of Genesis 3:15, who will make everything right. That's what we're doing, okay? That's Ruth. So we'll take a little break here, catch our breath a little bit, and then we'll pick back up in a few minutes and get the introduction of 1 Samuel, all right?